The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to accomplished fund manager Richard Staveley of Harwood Capital. So welcome, Richard.
Hi, Paul. Great to see you.
Yeah, well, massive congrats on the returns from the Rockwood Strategic, which I do believe has been the best performing small cap investment trust over the last 1, 3, and 5 years. So really well done. But before we sort of like dig into the sort of secret sauce behind that, I don't suppose you could quickly remind the audience of what type of stocks and what type of investor you are.
Sure, no problem, Paul. It's pretty simple, really. We look for undervalued stocks, very undervalued stocks, stocks that we think can at least double in value over 3 to 5 years. And we take our time in that kind of proper investment time horizon. We don't trade much. We just buy a stake, typically, probably get a bit engaged and active with the company, try and help it improve and unlock all that value that we see on day one. We typically buy proven business models or proven businesses that generate lots of free cash flow. We like it when they've got assets. It's beneficial whether it's sort of hidden or otherwise, whether that be tax losses or property or things that people haven't realized. And we not exclusively but majoritively look for recovery situations, because we think that's where the real behavioral biases and come through in the market, and where lots of other investors don't really like going, because it's a kind of difficult time and emotional time for the companies when we see the valuation opportunities. But what we look for then is operational, strategic, or management changes that can happen that we think then can unlock all that value and create money for us, for Rockwood shareholders, and anyone else that's on the shareholder register.
Yeah, well, you've certainly chosen a lot of sort of like, or better identify lots of sort of deep value turnaround there. And how active are you, and how important is that active element within that sort of investment thesis?
We are really quite active, not in a kind of sort of aggressive kind of American, we want to be in the newspaper shouting about, you know, what we want to complain about type way. But more behind the scenes, requesting and having multiple meetings with board members, with the management, and often with other shareholders, to try and ask them what they want to see, what they want to get out of it, whether they understand what changes are required. To put some numbers on it, though, we have 7 core positions currently. And of those 7 core positions, we have a board representative on the boards of those companies, or someone that we proposed that's gone on. And of our other 13 holdings, so we only have 20 holdings in total, we've also proposed someone onto the board of one of the others, and we're in process of doing that on a further one. So that would be, if you ask a normal small cap manager that same question, they literally will struggle. Even those that may be a bit more engaged than others will say 1 or 2. So we really are right at the top end of engagement as far as the UK stock market is concerned.
Yeah. Well, that certainly helps the other investors as well, because they get on board, then they know you guys are going to roll up your sleeves and sort of if it's required. Okay, let's move to some stocks that I know you've been buying of late, and a new purchase. Somebody tells me that you've been buying Capita, which is probably the deepest turnaround story that I've ever come across, because it was originally owned and it was a stock market darling. I think it was in the FTSE 100, owned by Neil Woodford, sort of 5 or 6 years ago, got sold off, and it basically, just for investors, is a sort of like a business process outsourcer to the public sector and to sort of corporates. Sort of specializes in contact centers, in call centers, in commercial, and then all digitization for the government. But what sort of attracted you? What's the sort of key investment thesis behind Capita? Why is this one going to turn?
Well, you're right, Paul. It's you basically won't find an investor who's happy, who's had a happy experience with Capita. I mean, it probably should just be called the widow maker.
Yeah,
or something like that. It did get all the way to the FTSE 100 on a kind of very aggressive kind of acquisition trail, which the market sort of slightly fell in love with, backed by Woodford. And then it all went to pot, and they got over leveraged. They lost operational control. There were contract and accounting issues, and it really was a total mess. And it's been in a long period of trying to sort all of that out. I mean, longer than most, to be honest, because the problems were bigger than most. But we think as a result of that, quite a few of the narrow part of the market that want to look at turnarounds probably got pretty burnt on the first phase of the turnaround, where they could see the value, but they basically went for it and then they've lost money in that phase. So even they've all given up on it as well. So I think it's possibly the biggest blind spot in the whole UK stock market. Why I'm saying that is because the market cap roughly today is about 225 million quid. Mm. The new CEO who's gone in is targeting 6 to 8% operating margins. That is not what they've been doing recently, but it is what peers do. It is a reasonable, and it's not exactly a particularly massive profit margin. I mean, the company used to do well over 10%, but if they just did 6% operating margins on a slightly larger number of turnover, talk about the size of numbers we're talking about in a moment, they would do £215 million of EBIT. The market cap is £225 million.
Yeah.
The sales are currently 2.7 billion. And essentially, the business has had too much debt, which it's been selling off businesses and paying that debt down. So it's got about 180 million of financial debt. A lot of investors, if they're just doing kind of superficial sort of work, will see a much higher debt number. But that's because it's got a significant number of leases on the balance sheet, capitalized about 500 million of leases. And that's because their business model essentially does use a lot of office space. But equally, it also it's got too much office space for a post-COVID working from home world. So that lease number is actually gradually coming down. They're exiting offices and consolidating that. In fact, Adolfo, the new CEO of Capita, has announced that he's upping the savings the company can achieve to 160 million in total, some of which he's reinvesting in the business. So where does this all boil down to? We think that if they can get the margins up to just over 6%, I've mentioned the EBIT number, but just over 6%, we think that the free cash flow number, now that the debt's paid down and the pension fund, which was massive and real problem, where they've done a deal with and injected a lot of the proceeds into, they stop having to put cash in and during the next 12 months, could come out at about 90 million of free cash flow a year. Now, for sort of short-term traders, that sort of an investor, I'd just be wary that it's still in that stabilization phase. This new CEO has arrived, and this next 12 months will be a cash outflow period. But we think the whole thing starts to inflect it during the next 12 months. And then when people can actually see this starting to inflect, this is a stock everyone will look back at, I hope, including us, and go, thank God we did buy a few at 225 million market cap, because you know they are on offer, and I do think it's a blind spot.
Mm. Is there any risk from the general election at all here? If Labour comes in and decides to insource a lot of these activities on the public sector side?
I don't think that's actually something that the Keir and the guys have been really promoting that they're going to do. I don't think, the PFI type approach, PFIs haven't been offered more broadly in terms of that kind of financing structure. I'm not sure insourcing on this sort of thing is something that either the civil service have the competencies to do, or that they, you know, well, they'll get the benefits from in terms of actually saving money. So I'm not expecting that to have a big issue. And they do everything from they manage pension funds for the Royal Mail. They do the TV licensing. They manage the TV licensing payments for everyone. They do the student loan company for students. These are the sorts of things that they've sort of taken off the hands of big government and are doing more efficiently. They can invest in the tech, and they have a great. It's really interesting when you look into Capita in more detail. It's only really the city that has a particularly negative impression of the name. And in private eye, actually used to call it Prapeter. But the if you speak to, which we have done, if you speak to government departments and the actual customers, they actually really they're a great yeah. supplier to government. They do what they say they're going to do. They've been delivering on their contracts. Been no operational issues for a long time. So
Ian Hislop from the private eye is well known for his yeah. pithy comments, no doubt yeah. about it. Well, we'll monitor that. Thanks for that. What about let's move on to one which has done really well this year, Filtronic, which does all things sort of wireless communications for sort of defense and aerospace, but recently won a really flagship contract with SpaceX, Elon Musk, Starlink, low orbit. Can you just take us through this one? Because it really has moonshotted the shares. And I guess the question now is that you've seen it before the move, is when do you sort of top slice and take profits? Because it's not that cheap if you look at earnings, unless they're going to really sort of exceed expectations.
Yeah, I think that last comment's the most important here, Paul. And some companies when something huge happens to them in terms of industry change or growth dynamic change for them. And I mean this, if not because it's the only stock that everyone seems to want to talk about at the moment, but a bit like Nvidia in the last sort of 18 to two years. Everyone sort of started to realize something big was happening with Nvidia's kind of end demand for its products as a result of AI. Nvidia has been around for a number of years, but the AI thing kind of changed it. The stock started performing, but it's been very difficult to work out how big is that sales opportunity going to be? And everyone's trying to model it, but basically everyone's been wrong for quite some time. It's been bigger and bigger, and the numbers keep moving. Filtronix does need significant upgrades to justify its current market cap. And we are holding the stock because we expect those are coming. We've done some work with some of the advisors to the company, and we think that the serviceable addressable market, i.e. the winnable addressable market over the next couple of years could be 200 to 300 million quid's worth of dollars worth of revenue opportunity. That's versus a current forecast sales for next year of about 36 million sterling of sales. We've got results coming up shortly, but we expect there to be upgrades at those results, and we expect to be further upgrades as they win more contracts from Musk. Musk needs to give them 48 million of contracts in order for his warrants that he's taken over Filtronic to be allowed to vest. Let's just think about that for a moment. I mean, no wonder it's captured the imagination. I mean, you're all over the stock market, Paul, but you tell me, is there any other stock that Elon Musk's bought in the UK?
Yeah.
I don't think there is. Mm. So SpaceX have taken this exposure alongside these contracts. However, those contracts are really linked to the ground stations, which is what Filtronic's product's gone into. And interestingly, the ground stations, obviously less ground stations than satellites, and there's about 100 or so in America, but they're starting to realize that because of the success of Starlink, that they are wanting to put more ground stations in, and they're also trying to future-proof the ground stations to higher parts of the wavelength, which Filtronic basically solves that problem for them. And each time you go up a wavelength, you need another part of the product. So it's a more valuable sale into SpaceX. So we think that the ground station contracts are basically inevitable, but they are also, it's public information, they are working on a prototype. They're prototype testing to go into the satellites themselves. Mm. And he's got thousands of these things. He's market leader. But he's also doing projects. This has been in the US press. He's got a kind of highly confidential $1.8 billion project around satellites with the US government for super secret satellites. Bezos, his sort of
competitor,
big rival, wants to put up his own Starlink-style satellite network. Bezos's rockets haven't been working as well as Elon Musk, so he's reasonably behind. But once he gets going, he's going to need this sort of technology as well. And there are lots of other people that are considering putting these low Earth orbiting satellite networks into space, from countries like India through to defense primes, through to people that just want their own private networks, that now, because Musk's rockets and made it much more affordable to fire up all these satellites, are going, well, this is actually something we'd like to do to our own. So in short, it's done really well. I mean, frankly, we bought the shares at 12p, started buying at 12p, and they're now 72p. I have sold a very, very small amount, literally only as a sort of honourable thing. So I can tell you that I've sold a very little amount. But, we still own over 5% of the company. And I can see, if they continue to win these contracts, I can see more. Now it's well over 100 million market cap. We start to see other institutional investors start looking at it and maybe starting joining the register.
What sort of position sizing would it get to a stage in these for the Rockwood Fund that you decide, you think actually it just gets too big? I mean, obviously you've top sliced because you've made such a great return, but
we've got 10% at the moment in the fund in Filtronic. It works like this. So we think the company is in a phase of building permanent strategic value to the low Earth orbiting satellite space supply chain. If that is the case, then there are a number of established players in the space market, from Lockheed to Smiths in the FTSE 100 to a range of other people, who will see Filtronic as a quite a small company, but with a critical involvement in that industry. So we think that we're still in a phase where we might feel a bit embarrassed if we've exited, even though we have a big position. You'll remember going back quite a few interviews ago, Paul, I think it was my very first, we were talking to you about how we'd kind of changed the name of Northbridge Industrial Services to Christchurch, bought a big position, sort of turn that around. That, just for context, that got up to 25% of the portfolio. So we're not scared of having big positions when we think everything's going right. This is the thing. Everyone's so, with the stock like this, it's very easy to go, oh, let's just move on. But the company's got net cash. It's winning orders. It's getting upgrades. It's got a clear strategy. And its end market is just opening up. So it's a bit like, everyone that sort of sold a few Nvidia 12 months ago or shorted it and all the rest of it's feeling kind of a bit painful now. We're not going to make that mistake when everything's going so well for them.
Yeah, well, okay, in that case, then run your winners. Rather than just make 100% return in 12 months, you've made five times. So 5x, not so bad. Okay, let's switch gears. Another industrial stuff. We've got Trifast, which again is really sort of like off the radar for most investors. It does sort of industrial fastenings for sort of like, vehicles and also lots of industrial applications. It's been through a difficult period. And now going through a turnaround. What's going to sort of change the dial on this stock?
Yeah, so it is, as you say, nuts and bolts it makes, both metal and plastic, which sounds like a very sort of commoditizable type thing. But actually, there is a commodities part of the market, but a lot of their supplies are sort of designed into products. So, I was up there recently. They've got a new national distribution center. No other fund managers have been there, just Harwood. And they recently opened it because they've been, as you say, restructuring the business to take about six sites down to one in the UK. So it's a really modern facility. I've lost my train of thought for what I was telling you up there now. But
basically, there's a lot of self-help basically
there's a lot of self-help going on. That's right. At the factory, we learned that they the black cab. There are 270 fasteners in a black cab, and they have the contract for every single fastener. So every time a black cab is purchased, they're in it. And they're not going to get swapped out for a different one. Mm-hmm. So I just stress that people think, oh, that cubby, they're just going to get killed by someone else. Once you're in, and they've got a very sticky client base across a range of industries, which they service around the world. So this is a brilliant, classic UK stock that's 90 million market cap, but basically has operations in the US, Asia, Europe, and the UK. In fact, it has 240 million of sales. Mm. When you say what could change, well, we've been rolling up our sleeves. So since we've purchased, there is a new chairman, a new CEO, a new CFO, And Nick Mills, Christopher Mills' son, who works on Rockwood with me, has gone onto the board of Trifast. We've also purchased 15% of the company at Harwood overall. So the Rockwood stake is part of that 15%. And it's a very simple thesis. In fact, I'm hoping this is going to be my sort of go-to simplest thesis of what we do as a style of investing. So they're currently making 5% margins. Mm. They used to make 10%. They used to make 10% pretty much year in, year out. And then the management changed and they kind of lost commercial discipline, focus, maybe not quite as well executed. Well, definitely not as well executed as they were. And they maybe didn't restructure as quickly as they should. They maybe weren't on top of their Asian business as much as they should be. But the reality is that that's required all these changes. The competitors make more than 10. In fact, there's a listed company in Switzerland called Bossard. It's quite interesting. It makes about 13% margins. And so we think it's completely realistic to expect the company to get back to 10% margins. And in fact, the company have committed and the new team have said that that's what they're shooting for at least. So if you run that through, well, if they get to 8% margins, it'll be on a PE of 8. Mm-hmm. But we have a kind of rule of, we have one of our sort of valuation rules we have is that there's quite a kind of magnetic pull between a company's operating margin and the EV to sales ratio that a company has.
Yeah.
And clearly that they've already got down the head. When we started buying at 90 million market cap, at 100 million of stock. So the stock's coming down and that's been reducing the debt. So there's only like 20 or 25 million odd of debt now. So maybe we've got an EV of 25 plus 90 gets you to, 115 million of EV versus 240 million of sales. So less than 0.5 of sales, which reflects where the margins are now. Mm-hmm. And so we basically think when the margins get up to 10%, the market will catch up or other people will trade buyers or others, this is a big industry, will notice. And we would expect it to get an EV to sales ratio of 1 to reflect a 10% yeah. operating margin,
yeah, agreed.
Which would, hey presto, get you to a market cap of 220, 230 million type of value. And we double our money in line with our usual plans. And it should take the new guys maybe three to five years, hopefully only three. And that's basically how it works.
That does sound a pretty simple concept, that one. So I like that one. Okay.
The only thing I would say, Paul, is that with the previous stock we talked about before, Tronic, where people go, well, I think I've missed it. I don't care what Richard says. It's just gone up a lot. I don't like stocks that have gone up a lot. Trifast is one. We're at our in price. We haven't made any money yet.
Well, if you tell the management team to sign a contract with Elon Musk on his on Tesla or on his SpaceX or on his rockets, then you might get that one going to the moon as well. Okay, let's move to one more. I know you've done a lot of heavy lifting. Pressure Tech, two divisions, one in oil and gas with their precision machine components, which I think they're selling off at the moment, getting quite close to actually completing a transaction there, and then the longer term business, which is the Chesterfield cylinders, which services the defense and hydrogen sectors and anything with big cylinders. So just take us through what the turnaround is there.
Yeah, sure, it's not been an easy ride, it's fair to say, but it could be close to a sort of butterfly moment, basically, where it just sort of emerges from it's not really a chrysalis, it's just been kind of horrific, really, to be honest, overall. Multiple misses to market expectations. The oil and gas business that they're selling, was just a really tricky market for a number of years, it was really the function of a prior management team sort of buying two or three different businesses. That business is actually in really good shape now, performing well. As I have to be just very careful about what I talk about because I am personally a non-executive director on the business. But the oil and gas business has been performing. It was loss making. It's now expected to be profitable. And the market cycle there looks good on a more broader pace. Look to hunting shares for details, for instance.
Yeah.
So the company stated that they had a number of interested parties in the business and have down selected one who's an exclusive DD to try and get it over the line. So, fingers and toes crossed. Why that's important is because we really think that this quite small business and the management team needs to be, you know, very focused. You know, it needs to be focused on one business. There's no synergies between the two, and it will allow essentially this other business to be kind of in the spotlight, the Chesterfield business. Now, Chesterfield, as you say, it's been around for a very long time. It also has an absolutely massive factory. And guess what, Paul? I'm out on the road. I was there last week, overnight in Sheffield, at the Novotel and at the factory. It's 110,000 square foot factory, which they have freehold. They own the freehold next to the M1. And it's where they make these cylinders. And you're right, it goes into defence. So they and particularly the submarine market, but also frigates and things like that. So they've won a contract this year to go on to the AUKUS program going forward as well as Hunter class. The business has had a huge amount of work from the Dreadnought nuclear submarine program in the last 2 to 3 years. And that's kind of drawing to a close as regards to they've done, you know, their work on it. And they now need to take the business in defense overseas. So we're at quite a sort of key inflection point. And often the key inflection points are relatively quiet. And then what essentially happens is they should start to get, so Naval, which is big European shipbuilding and defence contractor, are a big client for them. They also, second to that, they also need, because of this lull in UK defence orders now, we've sort of finishing the Dreadnought programme, they do require the hydrogen market to become much stronger than it has been. And, you know, that's not within their gift, but there has been now official government support. They're called the HAR, what's the right word for it? So the HAR phases, it stands for hydrogen administrative regime, whatever. But basically, there's two. The first one, it's got government funded and designated projects. And those are starting to, they're meant to start to being delivered in relatively near future. HAR 2 is a lot bigger than HAR 1. And it looks like that Chesterfield is in a very strong position to supply the cylinders into these hydrogen hubs. And what happened was, there was very briefly, they thought it was all going to be about kind of refueling stations, a bit like Shell stations all over. They had an exclusive contract with Shell before. And everyone thought that's how the hydrogen market would develop, but it doesn't look like that's going to be the way it goes now. It looks like it's going to be much bigger hydrogen hubs where entire towns in the UK sort of basically have, you know, take their whole buses and you have a hub that everyone can use for the hydrogen. And that enables other people to then move their fleets to hydrogen rather than the other way around. So I think and these, because they're hubs, they would require a lot of cylinders, so big contracts. So we're hopeful the pipeline over the medium term is quite big. The timing of when these things land is very unclear. But if they start to land, then that could be quite a meaningful growth opportunity. Well, not quite a meaningful, but a very meaningful opportunity for Chesterfield.
In the context of an enterprise value of £15 million for the whole group, how much is Chesterfield broadly worth? What sort of range? Obviously, there's lots of uncertainty in terms of that whole hydrogen stuff.
Yeah, it's not helpful for your listeners. I'm not going to be drawn on that. What I would say is this, is that Chesterfield itself in the last, for a number of years, has done between kind of 17 and 22 million of turnover. The Chesterfield business, like every year, depending on which contracts are landing for defence or otherwise. And then it's made then about 2 million of EBITDA from that, depending on, you know, which margins. Hydrogen is slightly lower margins than defence, as you might imagine. So that's the kind of business. So you can kind of probably do your own maths on that. We'll see what the market, if the hydrogen really takes off, then there could be a lot of value here. The defence business will be stable and long term, but quite lumpy.
Okay. Well, if it's work in progress and you're on the board, I'm interested. Okay, let's move to another one, which is a turnaround, which is RM Group, which again has been through the mill. It's sort of an ed tech or an education technology sort of expert in the UK. It does exam marking, but also a lot of technology supplies and so into sort of schools and I think probably in universities. It's got three key divisions. They put a new CEO about a year ago, and it seems to be moving in the right direction. But what's the sort of the latest on this one?
Yeah, so it totally is moving in the right direction. And yeah, Mark Cook started just over a year ago. He's a proven turnaround and transformation CEO. We've now got a new CFO. He's replaced a couple of the heads of the divisions. He's hired a new head of HR. They've hired a head of he's hired a head of digital. So the team's really in place now. They still have too much debt. So they've got around about £50 million, depending on your numbers tell you, but rough about £50 million. And but what we're really excited about is that they unveiled, having been in about a year and sort of getting under the bonnet of it all, the new strategy in about March, officially to the market, which was to provide more focus to RM PLC. Now, you may remember that the thing that we've been arguing about very strongly is that they need to have huge amounts of more focus in as much as we think that they should sell off two of the divisions. And the first division, we'd expect to pay off quite a lot of the debt, if not all of it, depending on which division they sold off, leaving the business with a unencumbered balance sheet and the two remaining divisions. Now, we don't think there's huge synergies between the three divisions, just the way the business has been built up historically. One of the businesses in there, the divisions in there, the assessment business, is an absolute cracker. I mean, really, it's a cracker pool. We're talking, it's got most recent results, it had about 42 million of turnover and was making EBIT margins of, I think, 22%.
Wow.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it does marking of exams, just for those that don't know it, marking everything from the ICAEW accounting exams to the International Baccalaureate, to A-levels and GCSEs this summer. Scanning, digitalization, it is the market leader in doing that. And this is interesting. Recently, they have actually announced that IB, who are based in The Hague, have basically given them a massive tens of millions of pound contract to also do all their other international baccalaureate stuff, like their diplomas and all the rest of it. So another major contract. So we see that 42 million going up. Now, on what we think is that division is worth at least 80 million quid now, possibly 100 million. And if they keep winning contracts, maybe more than 100 million quid. Put that in context, the company is a market cap of 70. And it's got the 50 million of debt, which hopefully one of the other divisions will pay off, giving you loads and loads of upside. So our sum of the parts is about 170 million for RM. But we do think it needs to, we do think the stock market will never give you, unlikely to give you 170 million. What you may need to see, it may give you 170 million if they see the board and the management team realizing 170 million value and committed to that. And we think that's the path they're on. Just to be clear, I think they're up for it's about 10p of earnings by 26. So we're on a So we're on a like a sub 10p out there, 18 million of EBITDA. It's never actually been actually loss-making. Its profits collapsed under the problems under the previous management team, but it's still a profitable business. The banks are very supportive. They extended out the debt. I suspect the banks have been shared the plan, so they're not stressed about their bank loans. And as you said, he came in a year, we get the change, classic Rockwood, takes about a year to sort of stabilize it out. And then we should see a really lot of delivery from this company over the next 18 months. I'm pleased to say we obviously bought them shares originally at 25 million market cap. So we're pretty chuffed. It's got up to 70, but I'm going to be very disappointed if we can't get it up to, 170 million.
Yeah. Is there any risk from the general election, like, in terms of if Labour comes in with education?
Well, I would go flip it the other way around and would say that this government, although they seem to be slightly light on commitments, aren't they? That education is one that the Labour Party really have historically always put more money into. I'd also add that the reality of education budgets, which have affected the other big division of RM, which does resources into schools, and I'm sure there are people on this call that are involved in schools that know about this, is you have your budget, and then you know the cost, the utilities pricing and energy pricings, as they went up, you weren't given more money, so you had to find sort of cost savings elsewhere. And guess what? It might be a new whiteboard or some more teaching aids, sadly, that the kids need as you keep the lights on. So that actually might be coming their way anyway from a cyclical perspective. But we'd expect a Labour government to possibly even, you know, spend a bit more. It hasn't, you know, everyone's quite rightly said, why don't we spend more on education? The Conservatives have spent, you know, have been pretty supportive of education spending themselves. We don't think that's a critical factor. And indeed, for the assessment division and indeed resources, they are selling overseas. So it's not just UK budgets. So guess what? Lots of former British colonies have adopted our kind of education type system, and they like our marking our exams. So they end up using RM to do their marking. Equally, some of the resources that the resources business develop themselves, the IP in there, including kind of very cool little robots that help kids teach how to learn the basics of coding. Guess what? American companies haven't got a good product, so they're selling those into America, which I thought was quite amazing to be doing, actually. So
good. Okay, well, let's move to another one. We've got in the financial sector, one which has actually performed really well in a short period, a bit like a Filtronic, is Funding Circle. And I know you talked about this down at Mellow in Chiswick in May sometime, but this has gone really well. Just for everybody, it's a platform that does effectively loans to small, medium-sized companies in the UK and funds those through from institutions. Did originally the plan from individuals, peer-to-peer lending and stuff. Anyway, it seems to have retrenched into the UK, which has helped the share price, and just recently announced that it was selling its sort of small fledgling US subscale business. Can you give us your view on this one and whether it is tempted to take to top slice, because you've had an absolute, you know, home run so far.
Again, I haven't sold a single share, Paul, and I have no intentions of doing that. This stock is going to continue to perform very well. Most fund managers haven't even met them for about 2 or 3 years in the institutional market, and most of them, the last time they met them, they either lost money in the stock or realised it was going to lose a lot of money. It was floated by Goldman Sachs at 1.5 billion market cap in 2018, and at Rockwood we were able to pick it up again for 110 million quid in February, now up to about just over 300 million of market cap. So why aren't we selling any single shares? Well, firstly, the business is stuffed full of assets, primarily cash. So it had 175 million of unrestricted cash, and it had 50 million of restricted cash, and then a small portfolio of loans worth about 60 million, which appears to be fairly marked, as you know, i.e. doesn't look to be aggressively marked, no sort of problems with impairments there. So huge amounts, like 250 million of asset backing, of which mostly is cash. We went in and said, what on earth's going on? You're valued at 110 million quid. Why on earth aren't you doing a buyback? I mean, it's just ludicrous. And they did seem to listen to us, not only did they, you know, and soon, relatively soon after, started a 25 million pound buyback. Which is a good starter for 10, but we expect them to be able to do quite a lot more than 25 million pounds, assuming there are any sellers of the shares. So that's been really good. Where we are now is that the second piece of our engagement with them was about cost cutting. So it did have a business and the board, which had 10 people on it in February, we're down to 9. And it's still probably too many for this business, but it also had a very much a growth mindset. So they kind of listed with quite a lot of cash, with a sort of we're just going to blow, you know, we can just spend the money, growth, it'll be there in the end. And a lot of companies kicking around that still probably have that kind of view, but might not get there. But they have been gradually very close to profitability, particularly in the UK, less so in the United States, which is why it's the right decision to actually exit there, because that was going to cost a lot more money to get through to profits. But in the UK, they're now expecting to go profitable the second half of this year. And why not? Because basically they spent 100 million quid building an absolutely leading edge lending platform. Digitalize has 2.5 billion data points in it. It's lent 18 billion quid so far to nearly 150,000 different businesses. And a small business that goes into it can get the application process takes not very long. You get an answer ready too quickly. And, you know, it's just a completely unbanked part of the market. But the key thing here is, when you get to covering the costs of running the platform once it's built and keeping it kind of best in class, you know, every single piece of business that comes in basically drops through to profitability. So I think this is going to become like the Hargreaves Lansdown of small company lending. Now Hargreaves has been through its own sort of cycles and obviously is in a potential bid situation now. But for many years, as they became a platform, people saw the profitability in that platform. It was on a very high multiple, as platforms typically do. So we can see a big multiple for this when people see this is a real business generating real profits. And in that regard, if they move in second half and then start to make profits next year, the current market forecasts after them making 35 million of PBT and then 50 million the year after. And we've engaged with them on cost cutting, and they've just announced a £15 million cost cutting program. It's the first proper big cost cutting program company's ever done. And, you know, we see them making material profits. Now, if you put a normal platform multiple, not even one which people get overexcited about, like 30 times or 40 times, but like 20 times on a kind of recurring beneficial kind of project, then you can see why we're not selling any shares at 320 million market cap, bearing in mind we've got loads of cash still as well.
Yeah. And just as a bit of a sort of anecdotal evidence, I get monthly offers actually from Funding Circle to take a 6.9% loan of about 169,000 was the last one. So they seem to be doing quite competitive to small businesses.
That sounds too competitive to you, Paul, I would suggest. I'm going to have to ring and call them in.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I was going to sort of jump at it when it was offered. Okay, yeah. Let's move on to another one, which is going through the sort of the mill that we both own. I own as well. It's Argentex, which is a B2B international payment Forex software platform. Does white glove services. New chairman within the last sort of 12 months, and obviously a new CEO, Jim Allman, who we both know. Can you take us through what your sort of your latest view on this one? Basically, the company now seems to be on a sort of a mission to really sort of get this business rocking and rolling again, but over a longer time frame.
Yeah, well, someone should probably do a PhD on behavioral science and the Argentex share price from a number of perspectives, because this is one that really challenges the fund manager, any investor's behavioral and emotional kind of approach to investment. And I would, you know, for me, Attili, I'm having to work very hard to make sure I'm looking through the noise and the emotion and doing the right thing, mainly because I've obviously lost money in this.
So have I.
Yeah, compounded by the fact that we first bought it at 70p. And then it went up to we sold some at £1.37 and now Wish had sold all of them at £1.37. So pretty frustrating. We then averaged down during last year. And then just because for those that are watching very, very closely, we kind of appraised, we may have just relative to other holdings, we probably got a bit too many and started selling a few. And we then actually were made inside and that they wanted to raise a bit of money. And we were actually supportive of the last raise in modest size. So where are we now? Well, the share price is kind of ludicrous. So I think the current market cap's 34 million. Mm-hmm. And I think the latest house broker numbers, which have come out from the new CFO, who I think is about his interim that will become permanent. So he'd be absolutely mad to get this number wrong. It's about 14 million of of genuine cash in for the business. So you've kind of got an EV of 20 million quid, and they're sort of doing trough sales of maybe 40 million. But if there's a bit more higher FX volatility, they could probably make 50 million. I wouldn't be surprised. Relatively quickly. Just remembering that they're at pains to tell everyone FX volatility has been kind of like under abnormally low of late. It wouldn't surprise me. Bearing in mind, they do most of their dealing is US sterling or euro sterling, that kind of stuff. Well, there's nothing like elections and in both of those continents that could stir the loins of people of a currency market, should we say. So I think if FX picks up, they're a bit better than that. So on like a very a fraction of sales. And the business has the capability of making, you know, high levels of profit. It did do historically, and they want to do in the future. But what the new team have said is that they're going to go through an investment phase to build out a broader suite of products in what they call alternative banking, which they think will make the customers more sticky, have more subscription base, have better insights into those customers, and eventually able them to both generate just as much profit, if not more. But also a much higher quality level of profit, which they think would then give them a higher multiple. And the elephant in the room here is Alpha, which I think kind of almost unashamedly, Argentic has been for some time a bit of a, you know, seen itself as a sort of fast follower. And Alpha is obviously on about 5.5 times sales that has developed these other products. So they're keen to sort of, replicate that and do that. Now, the problem is, well, not necessarily a problem, but it does depend. This is where we get into the emotions of it all. You know, they were doing 9, 10 million of EBITDA sort of thing. And the new proposal is to make they look very cautious numbers, but, you know, one and a bit, you know, one to two million.
Two and a half.
Yeah, one to two. It's probably a bit low, I suspect. Yeah. A bit two, then it's at 4 and a bit, and then eventually get to 8, so three years from now. That seems like quite a long time, particularly if you've already been Argentex and Argentex like I have for a couple of years to sort of sort it out. However, these things do take time. Maybe they're being really cautious about the time horizon it takes them to do. They've definitely been hiring people to achieve it, and we understand that from credible competitors. So in short, we think that you could cut from a shareholder value perspective. We think that the board and shareholders should be very open-minded to accelerating that whole process by being open-minded to corporate combinations with other players in this market. So if another competitor or near competitor or adjacent has kind of the products which Argentex could essentially just plug its clients into, which is essentially saying it's going to take 2 and a bit years to, you know, you could get all the benefits straight away by doing that. And there's probably quite a lot of cost in an Argentex that, you know, any emerging company wouldn't need. So we think it could be quite compelling. And the current price has absolutely nothing in for that happening, you know, whatsoever. So in short, we think limited downside here. This company does not appear to be going bust. It's been painful for us and for other Argentex shareholders, but we feel it's probably not one sort of that old phrase, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater. I would suggest that either one needs to be slightly patient and let the chaps deliver, or maybe more than slightly patient, really quite patient with them, or just sit tight and let's see if someone sees some industrial logic from combining with them. And, you know, we would be pretty open-minded to that.
Yeah, I think shareholders will win either way. But I would reiterate, actually, I was looking at the share price. It's, 28p compared to net tangible asset value, the last reporting date of just over 31p. So it's trading at less than net tangible assets.
Yeah.
And if they do get the turnaround strategy working, then I think you'll probably see a significant re-rating. Also, I would add, would be, you know, have they actually kitchen sink those forecasts, and hopefully, you know, we'll under promise and over deliver. And I suspect on the there is an opportunity to do that. So That's
yeah. I think that's the case. I think we what you know the way we think about these things is we you know we it's it looks very sensible here given likely upgrades, downside protection, all the rest of it. I just and so I'm be amazed if the shares don't move to a high level at some point and as that becomes clearer. It's just the sort of value that a offeror might offer now that still makes sense for them now. Might not be achieved despite all of that, even for some time. So
we'll both be patient and keep the fingers crossed too. I mean, I've actually spoken to Jim, and you probably have as well, and the guy is absolutely got a lot of experience and is really, really committed to turning this business round. So I don't think there's any a lack of desire on the management team to get this singing and dancing. Okay, let's move to just the last one. Let's go for the consumer sector. We've got Hostmore, which has been another one bit of a problem child. But it came out with a really transformational deal to buy the it basically operates the UK franchise TGI Fridays in the UK, the restaurant chain, been around for 30 years, pretty iconic name, and is actually going to merge in with the franchisor in the States for the worldwide at a later date. Can you take us through this one? Because I guess the big question is, it seems to make perfect industrial sense to do it, but it's a really tough consumer market for quick, fast sort of dining, etc. And their sales, even though people are going out to say to gastropubs, don't seem to be actually dining out on TGI Fridays cocktails.
Yeah. Which are very good value, I can tell you.
Spoken with a man with a hangover.
No, they are very good value. And the ribs are good as well. We've done quite a lot of due diligence on this. I genuinely mean this, you know, I see it as the riskiest holding within our 20 holdings.
Yeah.
And accordingly, it's around about just under 2% of the portfolio, which would be the kind of minimum we want in a weighting to make, you know, so we don't have any kind of half positions just for that. We really believe in it, but the minimum we have would be 2%. That's it. Just having said that, the risk always comes with reward. And I also think, despite all the other stocks we've talked about, maybe if Capital really turns it around, it might do the same. But like, basically, Hostmore could easily 3-5x from here if they pull this off. And why that is that twofold. Firstly, the merger, the reverse takeover, which you've just mentioned, is you know, very bold. It's, you know, essentially that the deal terms, it's a reverse takeover. Basically, they're buying it on 5.4 times EBITDA, the US global business. This is in the context of in that difficult overall kind of casual dining kind of area, the other franchise businesses actually trade on 14 times EBITDA. And this is the key thing people probably haven't looked at properly enough yet, is that essentially non-capital intensive franchise businesses, even in difficult markets, are, you know, you get your proportion of what's going on, the revenue. They're very profitable businesses. And if you've got an established brand, you know, you make money year in, year out. So your Wendy's, your Denny's, your McDonald's, all that stuff are on about 14 times. So the valuation up, so we'll get on to what we're on, but is very, very significant if we to get a re-rating and realizing that. Why that's sort of confusing is that the Hostmore owns about 90 franchisees. It is the franchisee in the UK. That was what the stock we originally purchased. The business they're buying has just over, I think it has 100 of owned stores, and then 480 of of franchise stores. It's a much more franchise heavy rather than corporately owned.
And those are around the world, are they? They're in airports. Well,
they're all around the world. They're also, you know, wherever you see a Swiftie tour going, there's one of them there. I know the ones that in the UK.
Does she like it?
The UK have been rammed with Swiftie fans in the last few days. So that business and just get the things, that business combined based on the last year's numbers. And we are in a bit of a blackout for numbers at the moment because of the deal going through. But if you look in the offer documents or the rest of it, basically the combined business was doing about 30 million of free cash flow. So this is really important. So the math works like this. If that is the case, maybe they don't do 30 million or they get back to 30 million, but it was literally last year's combined. It wasn't an easy year for either company last year. If you do 30 million of free cash flow, Host Small shareholders are going to own, if you buy the UK shares now, are going to own 36% of the combined business. Okay. If you put the 30 million on a 10% free cash flow yield, doesn't seem too, you know, unfair one either way. That would be a 300 million. You know, it's not the free cash flow yield you'd put on a franchise business, by the way, but just on a kind of well-run corporately owned restaurant business, you might put 10% free cash flow yield on, in which case that would be valued at 300 million. And Host Small shareholders would own 36% of that, which is, as you know, roughly 100 million quid. And the current share price is, the current market cap's about 28.
And so I guess it all hinges on whether they can get the like-for-like sales going, because they're currently declining, aren't they? Which is it's turning that round.
Not just that. This is why it's risky. They also need to get refinanced because both businesses had too high debt. It's a weird world, the world of finance. But bizarrely, by combining having decent amount of debt in America with the Host More debt, they actually have better chances of doing a refinance than when you just had 30 million of Host More debt. Yeah. So the deal actually means, so the deal is deal precedent on a refinancing happening. So the order of events we think are going to be, and I just sort of slightly fingers crossed that I haven't misunderstood what's going to happen, but we'll get an announcement that they've agreed a refinancing term for the combined business. That means the deal can go ahead. Then the deal announced that it happens, and then you'll get new forecasts and kind of how the company expects profitability to go forward. What we do think is going to be the case is, in terms of having long conversations with the company about, is that their mindset is very much focused on equity value and shareholder value. So what that means is that they are looking for a deal where they can, you know, get that debt down, yeah, and move to buybacks and buying back in their equity rather than, you know, rolling out this this mature brand. Furthermore, there will be a bit of growth, but it's likely to be a big debt to equity, free cash flow, sort of really strong free cash flow play. And as I said, just putting a sensible multiple on that for now gives you, you know, maybe quite, you know, a lot of upside. The growth, the like for likes will probably with consumers getting better, remember, Paul? You know, so we've got real wage growth coming through, inflation under control, employment's good. That's all sort of a good, you know, sort of good environment. I would say energy costs coming down. So I'm getting more constructive on UK
the consumer. I would agree. When I go out to Birmingham, absolutely the consumer's going, but they don't seem to be going to TGI's other than Swifties.
Well, it's maybe when you're trying, they do have a lot of customers. And not only that, if you in recent surveys, they're the fourth highest, you know, known casual dining brand. And the guys that run it in the UK have been gradually turning things around. So it is good value for money. And, you know, the food is differentiated. You can't really get an Americana style thing really elsewhere, can you? So
how do you have your ribs? What's the suggestion? Is it Chinese or is it barbecued?
Always barbecue.
Always barbecue in there,
definitely.
Okay, well, I'll look forward also to hearing about whether Funding Circle has been able to do the refinance on that one. We'll wait and see. But thanks a lot for your time. That's absolutely brilliant, running through all those stocks. Is there anything in terms of you've sort of top sliced or taken anything else you've been selling at all recently to generate cash, or are you still really sort of like looking to deploy it?
I'm not sure exactly when this video is coming out, but it's. I don't think it'll make much difference. We've been selling off our Young's shares that we received as a result of the City Pub Company. We don't think there's anything particularly wrong with Young's. We think it's extremely well managed. I think they'll do a good job with the City Pub deal, and we think it's you know a bit undervalued, except that as I started out, and this is critical, we are looking for stocks that can double from, you know, and we don't think it can double from here over the next 3 to 5 years. We might be wrong, but we think there are other things that's more obvious that can deliver that. So we've just been, but we've been managing the exit around England's campaign and the Euros, which does affect how well they do, which is why the timing of this video I'm not sure. So
At least they don't own pubs in Scotland because they went out a bit earlier, didn't they?
Exactly. Yeah. The second thing that I just want to mention to your anyone that's got through to the end of this, and thank you for your patience and interest if you have got through to the end of our chat today. But just, you know, the AIM market has been very difficult. I actually looked this morning and it's flat year to date. Yeah. Difficult year last year. And, you know, the truth is, you know, the AIM markets, the AIM all share index since launch in 1995 is minus 25%.
Wow.
The AIM market has been, it's a very tricky market. People have to really just be very careful about what you do, which stocks you get involved with, and do consider people that do it for their day job and expertise. The concept would be like you kind of pointed out our performance. You know, the last 3 years, Rockwood's up 70. Our NAV is up 70%. Share price more. But you know, we've proven that this approach, we can find the ones that aren't causing the problems in AIM. Our Gentex to one side, and of course, we'll get things wrong, other things wrong in the future. But on aggregate, we can work out where the risk rewards are. And I think that irrespective of market environments, so for those that are sort of worried about market environment or the rest of it, I would say that, you know, we are kind of proving what we think is that we can grind out a decent return for investors using our network and experience at Hartwood for the benefit of all.
Mm. And you eat your own cooking as well, because I think you own a slug of that the shares, don't you, of Rockwood?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I bought shares this year, more shares this year, more shares last year. I'm up to about 1.2% of the fund. Fund's now 80 million in NAV. And Christopher Mills, who's on the Rockwood Advisory Committee and founded Harwood, has bought just over 27% of Rockwood. So we're super aligned with shareholders. We love it. We love stock picking. And, you know, we have had a really great year so far. But as I keep saying, it's not been perfect. We've had problems with our Gentex and things like Trifast haven't gone anywhere. So we've got lots of things, including some stocks we haven't mentioned today, maybe next time, that we think are still quietly sitting in the portfolio, ready to go to the moon like Fultronic.
Brilliant. Well, I look forward to hearing about those next time. Thanks very much, obviously, for those terrific insights and your generosity with your time there, Richard. Brilliant to get those thoughts, etc. So look forward in touching base probably in about 6 months' time.
Yep, no problem, Paul. Well, thanks to you very much, and thank you to all the Vox community as well for listening in.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.